Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is May 22nd, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
Angela Meaden.
Hi, everyone.
And our special guest, James Hoff.
Hello.
All right, let's teach Angela to appreciate history.
So this week we are looking at the year 1875, and on May the 20th, I think it was, in 1875, we had the signing of the Meter Convention by 17 nations. This convention led to the establishment of the International System of Units, otherwise known as the scourge of physics textbooks everywhere, the SI units. So the SI system is a modern form of the metric system, and it's based on the digit 10. That's how millimeters, and 10 times that is a centimeter. Meter and so forth. It's the proper way to count, not like that other system, the imperial system.
Yeah, the imperial system sucks.
Right, for the record, there are only three countries in the world that don't use the metric system, and they are Burma. Anybody hear of Burma?
I've heard of it.
No, I couldn't find it on a map, though.
It's Myanmar now.
Oh, is that it? Myanmar. Liberia is another one, and then the other one is a little place called the United States of America. The metric system is, well, now anyway, it wasn't originally, but it's now become based on constants of nature. So the meter is measured by how far light travels in a certain amount of time, and that amount of time is
1/300,000th of a second.
Yeah, something like that. And then a second is defined in terms of how many times a cesium atom vibrates or something along those lines. I think the only exception in the metric system that isn't defined by a constant of nature, I think, is still the kilogram, which is defined by an artifact that sits in a museum in Paris.
I think what's important about the SI system is that we're just trying to make things as accurate as possible, you know, and everything has some kind of reference back to it. We're not using whatever they used to measure the length of the king's forearm or something, and that would then be the standard measurement for however he reigned. At least now we have more concrete standards.
And it's a little interesting fact that there are various precursors to the meter, including the arc of a pendulum of a particular length and so on, but the first popular definition of the meter was created by the French Academy of Sciences in the 1790s when they took the meridian, the Paris meridian, and then measured how long it is from the half meridian from the North Pole to the equator, and then divided that by a million to come up with the original definition of the meter. They actually commissioned an expedition to travel from Dunkirk to somewhere in Spain, I think it was Barcelona, and then to measure the distance, and then they could extrapolate. And, you know, it just shows you how actually quite complicated this kind of thing can be to come up with a convention. It doesn't really matter what the absolute value is. If a meter was 10 centimeters longer, it wouldn't matter. The key is that there's a convention that everybody agrees on, so that if I write down, you know, my experiment involved 10 meters of rope, you know, a guy in China can understand me. That's the convention, but it's important, not the absolute value of things.
All right, then, shall we move on to listener feedback? And up first, we have James Hoff with a comment about a smallpox vaccine.
Yes, this wasn't exactly how I got on the podcast. I didn't just comment.
But it is part of the reason.
Yes, sure. didn't really want to counter any of the points that were presented last week, just some additional information that kind of weighs on the decision that the World Organization has to make. As you'll remember from last week, there was a discussion on the smallpox virus and the last remaining samples that we have of them in labs around the world. There are two labs that have samples, one in Russia, one in the US, and the World Health Organization originally had a deadline of 1993 to destroy those samples, and that has obviously gone by, and they still have the samples, and they're deciding again this week on whether to keep them or not. Now, the meeting was supposed to happen on the 20th of May. It was bulleted on the agenda as time permitting. They'll discuss it. It doesn't look like they had time to discuss it this time. I don't know if by the end of the session, which is the 24th of May, they'll have a final decision. We'll see. But what complicates the decision a little further is that the study into the virus is also to produce a better vaccine. Now, the vaccine that we've been using since the 70s isn't quite appropriate for people who have immune deficiency. currencies. So there's, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, a huge section of the population you can't give the vaccine to. So if we were to get a smallpox outbreak, it would wipe everybody out. And, you know, you'd sort of think, well, how could this come about? It's possible there's some repository of it somewhere that nobody knows about.
Owen mentioned the ex-Soviet states where there might still be some pockets of smallpox still in the wild. Let's hope not, but it's possible.
Sure, absolutely. I don't quite think that they'd be in the wild unless they had, because they would be infecting people and we would notice, unless it had evolved into some kind of retrovirus or something that doesn't display symptoms. But there was actually a smallpox scab found in a medical textbook in a library in 2004. The CDC went down to the library and dressed up in their fancy uniforms and picked up the sample. It turned out that it was probably too degraded to infect anyone, but there's no guarantee that there's not another sample like that somewhere in the world we don't know about. And if we've got no effective vaccine, we've got no copy of the virus to test on, then, you know, an infection from something like that could just wipe out the world all over again.
There was actually an episode of the show House where some tourists were diving at I think it was like 18th century shipwreck, and they brought up a bottle that was still intact and sealed, and they opened it and there was a worry it could be smallpox. So something like that is entirely possible.
I'm just not ever going to a library again. Seriously, the thought of opening a book and a smallpox scab falls out just grosses me out so much.
You can't catch smallpox from the internet.
Yes.
Well, you don't know what I do with your laptop when you're not looking.
Oh, stop it. You are so incredibly disgusting.
And now let's look at a homeopathy dilution error that we made.
So in episode 9, we talked about how a bunch of homeopathic people, I will prevent myself from using expletives, were advising HIV positive people that once they are on homeopathic preparations, they could forego their HIV treatments such as antiretrovirals. And we provided a little bit of background on how homeopathy works, including a discussion about the process of dilution. And I was speaking off the top of my head, and I made a mistake. I said that if you take a preparation and dilute it 1 in 10, 30 times, what that yields is a 30C preparation. But that's actually wrong. The C stands for the Roman numeral 100. If I diluted 1 in 10, 30 times, that would be a 30X dilution. If you diluted 1 in 100, 30 times, that would be a 30C preparation. And Hahnemann, at least according to my sources, said that 30C preparations were appropriate for most complications. So that is the dilution with the magical shaking in between that he promoted. And then the second slight mistake is, I forget which episode, but someone also mentioned that during a discussion of reflexology, all the examples we gave or the definition we gave of reflexology concerned the feet, where in actual fact, the people who believe in this pseudoscientific nonsense actually believe the feet, hands, and ears can be manipulated to treat internal medical conditions. But it remains as idiotic, whether it's ears or feet or hands.
Yeah, the same principle still applies. There is no homunculus in either your feet or your hands or your ears. All right, our third piece of listener feedback is probably our most commonly asked question, and that is, where can I find you on iTunes? And the answer to that is, you can't. And this is a long, sad story that I will now regale you with. And that is, we originally submitted our podcast to the iTunes podcast directory around about the time when episode 3 came out. And our initial submission was rejected by Apple for technical reasons. They gave us some technical spiel that we looked into, and we checked it and everything was fine. So we resubmitted our application to the iTunes directory. Since then, we've had absolutely no response from Apple. So we're kind of at a loss about what to do. We've resubmitted it again, and there's still been no response, and we're still not in the directory. So, you know, we kind of don't know how to fix it from here. So what we're hoping is, if any of you guys know anything about the iTunes store listing process and might be able to give us some pointers on how to get this resolved with Apple and with iTunes, we would greatly appreciate that feedback. In the meantime, there is a manual override ride of sorts that you could do. If you go to our website at consiliencecast.wordpress.com and you click on the iTunes logo on the right-hand side, it'll take you through to the Feedburner page, and from there you can click on a link that will manually add our podcast feed to your iTunes. So you can do it that way. But if you search for us in the iTunes directory, you won't find us there. So that's what we're trying to resolve. And we're hoping that once we get listed on iTunes, that'll make us available to a lot of users who don't necessarily know how to figure out RSS and other kinds of more complicated ways of subscribing to the podcast. So any assistance that any of you guys could offer would be greatly appreciated.
We'll also include in the show notes a description of how to add us manually. There is that option of clicking that link, which then launches the application and so on. But you can also go to advanced options in iTunes, say subscribe to a podcast and add the Feedburner feed. I'll write down the steps you can follow. So if you have iTunes, you can subscribe manually to us, and that works perfectly. We're just not in the directory yet.
Yeah, and it's an unfortunate reality of the medium that most people associate the Apple iTunes podcast directory with podcasts. People tend not to think of podcasts as being something outside of Apple, which is frustrating for me as an Apple hater because I don't even own an iPod, and I'm proud of that fact. And yet, I'm not only an avid podcast listener, but I have one of my own.
But Steve Jobs invented the podcast and the computer and the GUI and everything else. And how could you not be an Apple fan?
So was Steve Jobs working for Xerox then, by any chance?
No. Apple was there in the 19-whatevers that it was invented. It wasn't Xerox. Just the myth.
Right. He invented the mouse himself, of course.
Yeah, don't you guys know? Apple was there at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden.
Yes, God. That it was.
Most important news article for today is the fact that the rapture hasn't happened. Hands up, everyone who's surprised.
This is a podcast. Okay, no one's hand went up. I can confirm this. We all have voted. And yeah, so it turns out Harold Camping, who is a American guy who has for the last 50 years been a devoted studier of the Bible.
Yeah, so Harold Camping convinced not only himself, but thousands of other people around the world that May 21st, 2011 would be the day of the second coming of Christ, and that we would all say goodbye to our Christian listeners as they were beamed up into heaven, and the rest of us would stay behind here for the after party. It didn't happen. It didn't happen at all, and we are still here, and Harold Camping has egg on his face in such a big way, but of course, we're never, ever going to hear about that, because what happens now is cognitive dissonance sin, and Camping and all of his followers are going to start rationalizing how and why it didn't happen. He's going to come up with some kind of stupid excuses and do this all over again in 10 years once people have forgotten that he's been wrong twice already.
Well, of course, if you go to familyradio.com, speaking as of the time of this recording, there has been no mention on Camping's website about his failure in predicting the rapture. What I'm surprised about is the absolute certainty of their prediction of the end of the world yesterday. That they left absolutely no wiggle room. It was, let's put it this way, if I was predicting the end of the world, I would have left myself an out, right? I would have hedged my bets a little bit and said something like, probably, there's always a chance I could be wrong, but I believe very strongly that this is the case, or something to that effect. They did nothing of the sort. In fact, in the Pod Delusion podcast of this week, there was an interview with one of Camping's cult members in which he restated this case very clearly. Shall we have a listen to that clip quickly?
Other than repentance, is there any hope for all of us? For example, do you think we could ask God to delay judgment just a little bit, or perhaps cancel it altogether?
No, there's no possibility of that. No,
okay.
There is no possibility that even if the whole world repented, it's God's plan to destroy this world at some time. The Bible's always been very clear about that.
The reasoning behind the belief that the 21st of May is Judgment Day seems to be highly complex. Even if you might say God is infallible, isn't there just the tiniest possibility the scholars who discovered this Judgment Day code in the Bible might have misunderstood the text? Would it be plausible to assume that fallible human minds might not be able to perfectly interpret a text of this complexity and age?
There is zero possibility that we are incorrect about May 21. It is God guaranteed, or the Bible is the one itself that is guaranteeing this.
You speak of certainty and rock-solid guarantees, which to a non-religious person like myself sounds immediately strange. Isn't there even the tiniest bit of doubt? There's almost no aspect of human endeavor that we could say that we have accomplished perfection. Isn't there any room for possibility of misunderstanding?
No, I'm sorry. That's a very common thought that people have. They just want the child of God to admit, or just, if this by chance doesn't happen, what will you do on May 22nd? No, that's not possible. God has locked it in. He's the one who has confirmed the date.
Wow.
That is cult-like thinking. That really is quite, that's pathological almost in its closed-mindedness. Look, it's one thing if the Bible contained a verse, and verily on the 21st of May 2011, there shall be a great earthquake that tears the earth asunder, and the chosen one shall be raised up to gaze upon the likeness of God. You know, if that was in there, then I could understand the certainty, but making all these suppositions and adding all these weird numbers and concluding that this number is important, therefore we add it together to that other number,
and the utter certainty. These guys were so convinced that yesterday was going to be the day, that was it. The world was coming to an end. Judgment Day is upon us. Yay, let us rejoice. And yet here we sit with no earthquake, no piles of empty clothes on
no
the floor.
No large earthquakes.
Well, right, yeah.
There were earthquakes.
Yeah, of course, there were earthquakes.
There were earthquakes every day.
Not of magnitude these people said we should expect.
Can you imagine the mental gymnastics that guy must be going through this morning as he's waking up?
It's actually quite interesting. I actually want to mention a bit of background. There's a very famous case study in psychology. In 1956, the social psychologists Leon Fessinger, Henry Reichen, and Stanley Satcher wrote a book called When Prophecy Fails. And this was a case study, a fascinating one, of a Chicago area cult called the Seekers. And their leader, one Dorothy Martin, was convinced that she could communicate with UFOs. It was a UFO cult, and she could communicate
with aliens on the planet Clarion through automatic writing. So she'd sit down and just sort of write whatever comes to mind, kind of thing. You know, you try not to think and you just write freestyle, and
stuff would sort of come out. And that supposedly was a method of communication with the aliens. And this lady predicted that on December 21st, 1954, there would be massive floods, and the whole earth would be destroyed. The United States would become like an ocean, essentially. And their little cult would be whisked off to safety on a UFO. And the reason these social psychologists wanted to study these people was because they wanted to see what would happen when December 21st came, and firstly, they weren't saved by the aliens, and secondly, they weren't killed by the massive disaster. And this is, Angela mentioned cognitive dissonance, and Festinger and his colleagues were the ones who came up with the whole concept of cognitive dissonance, and it grew out of this particular study. And what happened, fascinatingly, is instead of saying, oh, we were wrong, and saying, oh, well, so much for that one, let's give up this belief. On the contrary, they were even more convinced in their belief than they were before. Now, this applies specifically to people with deep conviction. So I'm pretty sure that someone who's just follows along to this May 21st thing, who, you know, maybe thought, oh, it could happen, maybe hedged their bets a little bit, went out for an expensive dinner the Friday night or whatever the case might be, they probably wouldn't be affected by cognitive dissonance as much. But people who were very, very firmly into this cult, who gave up their jobs, who sold all their possessions, and so on, instead of these events just confirming their deeply held firm convictions, for which they have made various sacrifices, and which they now cannot deny that they had made, they went out and engaged in all sorts of mental gymnastics. In this specific case, Dorothy Martin said, and I quote, The little group, sitting all night long, had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction. So instead of saying, oh, we were wrong about the end of the world coming, she came up with this another message, you know, through this freeform writing that said, it's because they believed so hard and, you know, they were such true followers of this cult that God saved the world because of them. And interestingly, before these events, they sort of shunned publicity. They wouldn't talk to the media, and or they did so only very grudgingly. And after the events, they wanted to get social proof. They wanted to be validated in their beliefs. So they went out and sought publicity very aggressively, phone journalists and say, look what we've done. We've saved the world. It would have ended. But because we believe so fervently in our little cult, God decided to save us and to spare us.
Well, luckily for us, that can't happen with Harold Camping, because they specifically stated that no matter how hard we believe, we will not stop this from happening.
I think it was very clever of Salim Fadli, who conducted that interview, to ask that question so specifically, so as to corner that guy in.
Beautiful.
I suspect Camping will not do is he'll just say, oh, he will have serious cognitive dissonance. He will suffer serious discomfort mentally, I think. But because they're involved, his calculations, his numerological inventions, require so many suppositions and assumptions and so on, he's probably going to find something somewhere, you know, he made some sort of mistake and he you know, the devil interfered or some such. And he's going to find some way of altering his equation, and now it's going to be, I don't know, 2012 maybe, or 2015 or whatever. Although he is 89 now, so he probably doesn't have all that much time left on this earth.
Mike, you've used the word cognitive dissonance a few times. Would you mind defining that for us?
Sure. It's just the process an individual goes through when he or she has two conflicting or seemingly conflicting beliefs at the same time. And cognitive dissonance is both a theory of how this happens and a description of, you know, the state of affairs. And people engage in all sorts of mental gymnastics when this happens, especially if those two beliefs, or at least one of these beliefs, is deeply held, like the world will end on the, you know, May 21st, and then there's an obvious counter to that, like you can't possibly deny that the Earth didn't end. Now you have these two conflicting beliefs and you have cognitive dissonance. The theory predicts you're going to find the easiest way of reconciling these two beliefs as possible. You're going to try to conserve as much of your deeply held conviction as possible. You're not, very few people, some people it happens to, some people, maybe, you know, a few will say, well, look, this convinced me, maybe I'm going to take a more rational approach. But most people will say, you know, Harold Camping was maybe interfered with by the devil, or he got his math wrong, or something or another. But what they won't give up is their fundamentalist Christian belief that the world is 7,000 years old, you know, that kind of thing, or that the rapture is nigh. It has been nigh for how many years? 2,000 odd years, but anyway.
Yeah, this all reminds me of that movie with Nicolas Cage from a couple of years back, Knowing, a rather terrible movie. It was all about this teacher who found these predictions buried in a time capsule, and ultimately the last prediction was that the world would end, and there were a series of short-term predictions that started to come true. Now, my challenge to all these Bible code numerologists is that they should be producing the short-term predictions that we can check first. They go straight for the big prize at the end. The world will end on this day. We know it because all these historical events fit. Well, you can retrofit your data to make it appear any way you want to, but you can't make a short-term prediction that would come true accidentally. You'd have to make a series of short-term predictions, then we'd take you seriously. Then we would say, okay, fine, we'll take this end of the world seriously.
And to be clear, these predictions would have to be specific, not like some psychic that we discussed on the Osama bin Laden thing. Someone famous will meet a tragic end in the water. I mean, you know, it needs to be specific on the order of, there will be an 8.5 magnitude earthquake in Chile on December 17th, 2011.
Yes, exactly. Because, I mean, a lot of them would go for the easy predictions. There will be an earthquake in California. Well, actually, there will be an earthquake in California today. It just won't have a huge magnitude. There will be hundreds of them this year, but you have to make a prediction saying it'll be over 8 on the magnitude scale or something like that.
So we have a Christian left behind Armageddon. And Owen, tell us about zombies.
Yes, zombies. This one's for you, Mom.
Yes, while we've managed to survive one end of the world, we have another scenario for the end of the world that's being promoted by the CDC.
and no less unlikely, I'll put to you.
I tend to agree.
Zombies are possible.
The CDC is promoting zombie apocalypse readiness. Seriously.
Well, on some definitions of serious.
Well, they really are. Now, the CDC are the Centers for Disease Control, which is a U.S. government agency responsible for tracking and treating epidemiological threats. So when it comes to virus outbreaks and that sort of thing, they are those guys, right? They're in charge of that. And they have recently launched a marketing campaign promoting survival strategy for Zombie Day, Z-Day, as some people like to call it, using common sense survival tips. So, you know, things like have a supply of extra water in your home and have spare batteries and torches and things like that in case the zombies come. Now, the interesting thing here, of course, they're not really promoting the idea that of a zombie apocalypse. The idea here is that these things would be useful in any kind of outbreak. So if you have a smallpox outbreak in your town, or if you have an earthquake or a terrorist attack, these sorts of precautions are common sense under those scenarios as well. So you can use your Zombie Day survival kit in those sorts of situations too. And that seems to be what they're aiming at.
Of course, the very first thing you need to do to prepare for the zombie apocalypse is read the Zombie Survival Guide by Max Brooks.
Yes,
which,
yeah.
Which is a complete and very accurate guide of the history of zombie outbreaks and what are the best weapons and best strategies and so on. I highly recommend it for the inevitable zombie apocalypse.
Right, and you should totally watch some zombie movies as well. I recommend Shaun of the Dead as probably being the most accurate depiction of a zombie apocalypse.
No, 28 days later, that's how zombies really happen. It's a clever little strategy. Everybody and his mother has a zombie book out now. In fact, Angela has a story out in the anthology Rotting Tales, a zombie anthology edited by Jesse Mary Roberts. So it's very good.
Thank you.
I'm just promoting my wife's stuff. What can I say? But zombies are exceedingly popular at the moment. It really, where did this latest zombie thing start?
I don't know. It's just a pop culture phenomenon. These things come and go.
I haven't read the CDC preparation guidelines, but I think the most important question, and I hope they answer it, is how many shotgun shells do you need? It's got to be there, otherwise this is a pathetic preparedness guide.
Yeah, actually, shotgun shells and ammunition in general is not covered. What they do cover is things like water, food, medication, tools and supplies, sanitation and hygiene, and that sort of thing. That there isn't even a guide on how to turn a baseball bat into an effective zombie-killing weapon.
I mean, a baseball bat virtually is an effective zombie-killing weapon as long as you have a mask on so you don't get splatter, you know?
You'd think that their guide would include that kind of common sense thing, but they seem to have overlooked the whole defense angle of zombie preparedness.
Well, you know, what's better, a machete or a baseball bat? You know, and it depends on which kind of zombie and what kind of level of outbreak you've got. Is it a level 1, 2, or 3, or 4? Right? You have to be specific here. Come on, CDC. I demand a better guide than this. Sure, medicine and stuff, that's important, but so is the weapon of choice. And in fact, I don't think a shotgun is necessarily the best weapon due to its limited range.
Well, sure. Once you're out of shells, though, you can just swing it.
True.
And it depends on what kind of zombies you're facing. Are you facing the, you know, Romero tough zombies that are slow, or 28 days later fast zombies, or as I like to call them, the realistic zombies?
Oh, God.
Of course, this isn't the first time that a zombie outbreak has been used for serious purposes, serious ends. A couple of years ago, Philip Muntz and colleagues released a paper using a zombie outbreak as a metaphor, in essence, for an epidemiological paper.
I remember that.
Where they looked at the epidemiology, the science behind tracking an outbreak of zombies and what the optimal strategies would be for dealing with it and how to contain the outbreak and that sort of thing. So, this is important science we're talking about here.
Didn't they conclude we're all doomed, essentially, with their assumptions of how the zombie...
It depends on how quickly the virus spreads, is what Muntz came down to. So if it spreads quickly and it has a short incubation period and people react slowly, we're all doomed.
I think even in his best case scenarios, we were still talking about total infection in a couple of days, and that's not enough time for the CDC to actually find out what's causing the zombiness in people to get a cure. So that was a pretty dismal paper on, surely, on the outcome of humans.
Surely you mean worst case scenario? Anyway.
No, the worst case scenario was everyone was dead in a few hours as opposed to a few days.
Okay. Well, so the bottom bottom line is, come on, CDC, do a better job, you know, do some experiments, you know, take some pigs and test their various ballistic of different weapons and so on, and come up with a proper guide here. It's all good and well to be prepared for a terrorist outbreak, but when the real stuff happens, you know, when the zombies come, inevitably, you know, we need to be ready, and who else to protect us but the CDC?
Is a chainsaw on a pole really the best weapon?
Well, until you run out of fuel, yes. And of course you get 50 points for style for every zombie you kill that way. I think we should probably move on. So zombies don't have much of a brain.
And they do like to eat brains.
Brain evolution, so yeah.
How did the brains, which will inevitably be eaten by zombies, evolve?
So, Timothy Rowe, Thomas McCreaney, and J.G. Lau published a paper in Science this week, which basically looks at how our sense of smell may have helped mammals' brains evolve to the size that they are. So, they used high-resolution X-ray CT scans to get a 3D cast of the inside of two fossilized skulls, which they then compared with the brains of 27 other primitive mammals that lived between 65 million and 190 million years ago, and also the brains of 270 living mammals. And what they found is that the sense of smell may have forced our brains to evolve by causing the growth of some of the parts of the brain that are responsible for processing that data. So the two skulls came from mammals known as Morganucodon and Hadrocodium, which were sort of mouse-sized mammals that lived between 195 and 205 million years ago. The Morganucodon is possibly a transitional fossil between reptiles and mammals, and that's one of the things that makes it so important, because what this shows is that the brain case of this creature was nearly 50% bigger than those of earlier Triassic reptiles.
Relative to body size.
And that this enlargement of the brain case was in the olfactory bulb and the olfactory cortex specific. So that's why they think that the sense of smell was driving this growth in the brain. And the same goes for the Hadrocodium. That little mammal also had a growth of about 50% larger again than the previous one, which was also driven by olfactory brain growth.
What they found is quite important. As far as I know, this is the very first direct study of mammal brain evolution, and it's something of a puzzle of why mammal brains are so much larger relative to body size than other organisms. So human brains are especially large, but mammals generally have exceedingly large brains for their size compared to reptiles and fish and so on. And one of the open questions is, well, why did mammals evolve these large brains? What this study seems to show is that the olfactory processing regions of the brain were the first ones to expand dramatically in the mammal brain. Now, that does not mean that the other areas of the brain enlarged as a result of this process. There might be a common cause. So say, for example, there's some factor X which caused both the increase in the olfactory regions of our brains and the non-olfactory regions, but it's at least suggestive that the sense of smell could have been the earliest important cognitive functions that mammals had a big edge on over dinosaurs. There was some speculation, I can't now find where I read this, that what could have happened is that the sense of smell was more important to mammals because mammals were mostly nocturnal when the dinosaurs were still around, and that it was a way to outfox dinosaurs. Now, that does unfortunately go against some recent evidence from studying the eye bones of various dinosaurs that found you in fact had nocturnal dinosaurs as well. So it's unclear why this happened, and it's also unclear how this relates to the rest of mammal brain evolution. But that said, it's still a significant improvement over previous studies, because previous ones had to operate upon supposition. Here we have actual empirical data doing what looks like to me a very large comparative analysis between different fossils using advanced techniques, importantly techniques which aren't destructive either. So these techniques can be repeated in 20 years when the technology has improved, you know, tenfold or whatever. And hopefully this will result in a better understanding of brain evolution generally, and specifically also human evolution. Perhaps the same techniques can be applied to, you know, the study of early human ancestors and look at endocasts of Australopithecus versus at the earliest Homo and see which regions of the brain were the ones that grew first.
Right, so they're not suggesting that this sense of smell development is the primary drive in mammal brain size evolution, right? This is just one particular part of our history, and during that time in our history, it seems to have been one of the motivating factors. At other times during our developments as humans, for example, there may well or would probably have been other factors that have cropped up along the way that spurred our independent growth spurts, and the same would be true of presumably whales and dolphins. They would have had their own independent factors that are not necessarily related to the sense of smell. All right, then let's move on to to another brain scanning news story, and we're going to look at why people who like Apple are religious crazy people. The internet has been all abuzz in the last couple of days about a study, in scare quotes, that was released as part of a BBC documentary called Secrets of the Superbrains. Now, in all fairness, this documentary isn't available to us here in South Africa yet, so we haven't actually seen it. But I've done my preparation based solely on reading internet reports from people who have seen it and who have reported on it. So I'm going on secondary sources here. So please forgive me if I make any glaring accuracies, but also please let us know. From what I can gather, the claim is that an fMRI scan of a prominent Apple fanboy revealed that his brain responded to Apple brand imagery in the same way that a fundamentalist religious person's brain responds to a religious iconography. So just to remind you that an fMRI stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging, and it's a technique that uses a magnetic scanner to monitor the activity inside your brain at a kind of a macro level, right? It's not very precise, but it can kind of tell you which bits of the brain are most active at any given time.
It measures blood flow, so
right.
The assumption is the more active a particular region of your brain is, the more blood it needs, and so if there's a spike in the blood flow to a particular region of the brain, therefore that region of the brain is active. That's very simplified, and there are also complications, but that's the basic sign.
Right. So it's a useful technique to at least point us in the right direction in terms of figuring out brain function and that kind of stuff. And of course, those of us who hate Apple, of which there are several of us recording on this podcast, we were all like, yeah, we knew that. We weren't surprised by this at all. And the internet at large were all like, lol, at Apple. Apple fanboys, lol.
At least the ones who didn't go TLDR.
Right, exactly.
Oh, you guys are such dorks.
You're one to speak. Miss, I'm a published zombie author.
I'm just cool. And I own an iPod and I use it regularly, so you know, but I'm not very religious, so I don't get it.
Well,
maybe you have to reach some like higher level of Apple fandom.
Yeah. You saying I'm not very religious is like me saying I'm not very pregnant. But anyway.
Yeah, I gather this is referring more to the kinds of people who camp out outside the Apple store when the new version of the iPhone is released. You know, those sorts of people, right? The real Apple fanatics, the kinds that we point and laugh at.
I point and laugh at anyone who uses an Apple product.
Well, yeah, so do I, to be fair. But now, based on the best sources I could find about this story, it unfortunately doesn't seem to be all that convincing, all that sound. From what I can tell, there was only one Apple fanboy who was subjected to the scan, and this guy is a notable one. He runs a prominent Apple fan blog, so he's the high priest of Apple fanboyism. So really we're looking at the same problem that we had with the bee and cell phone story last week. We have a ridiculously small sample size to really be able to derive any meaningful conclusions about what's going on here. Also, I haven't been able to find any references to any studies that have been published on the subject. For as far as I can tell, this is just one stunt, really, that was performed as part of the making of this documentary. And also, to be fair, it seems that the documentary also drew similar conclusions about other major brands like Google, and you know, which I would describe myself as the high priest of Google fanism. Google was one of them. I think Microsoft is one of the others, and various other major important brands that people are known to become fanatical towards. I think it's a little bit unfair for people to point the finger solely at Apple fanboys. But with that said, I think this is an interesting question, one that merits further study, and I'd like to see some real science being done on this question to see what the correlation is between religious fanaticism and this brand loyalty.
Yeah, it's an interesting
interesting topic.
It's not implausible that they would recruit the same kinds of brain areas. Mm. But, I mean, and even if they did, it's unclear what that would mean. I mean, that's a lot. I've long been a skeptic of computational neuroscience using scanners like fMRI, because it's really unclear even what it means. Okay, so area X is lit brighter than area Y, and what does that really actually tell you? Sometimes with appropriate comparisons and large numbers of people, you can probably come up with interesting conclusions that are suggestive and so on, but I've never been a big fan of this sort of, it's been criticized as blobology, you know, these pictures of fMRI pictures, and they, you know, one area is lit brightly and another isn't, and there are all sorts of criticisms of the Bold signal, which I talked about before, the assumption that the brain area with the most blood in it is the most active. That's not actually always true, and there are all sorts of problems with fMRI, which is why I'm a big fan of the new techniques invented in neuroscience, a specific technique called optogenetics, which can't be used in humans because you must first genetically engineer brain cells to incorporate a bit from an algae, I think it is. So the neuron fires after it has been stimulated by a particular frequency of light. But fMRI techniques are extremely limited, and especially if it's not a published paper. You never know. There was a prank paper a couple of years ago where someone took a dead fish and did an fMRI scan of it and came up with some results. And there was actual Bold signal in it as well. And there was another famous paper called Voodoo Correlations, where we're criticizing the methods used in fMRI research. So there are big problems with this kind of thing. And the fact that this is being done as part of a stunt for a documentary, meaning you know, a bunch of journalists are in charge of it, does not suggest that the utmost rigor is going to be in evidence. But hopefully someone will come along, maybe inspired by this, and study it properly with appropriate number of subjects and appropriate methods. And who knows, maybe something interesting comes of it.
Yes, and it should be noted that just because this isn't necessarily good science doesn't mean that Apple is not still evil. We're so never getting listed on iTunes.
Yeah, guys, and you wonder why it hasn't happened yet. Everybody saw your name and went, block that guy.
All right, well then, let's look at another news story, this time about robots taking over the world. Is that what's happening, James?
Well, in a way, sort of, as the headlines would suggest. There's been headlines going around the internet. Ilingo droid robots invent their own spoken language.
Yay!
Sort of evokes these images of R2-D2 arguing with C-3PO. And so all of these stories are based on a study that was recently released by Ruth Schultz and her colleagues at the University of Queensland, and published by the IEEE at their recent conference. If you're expecting, as the news headlines suggest, that these are robots that have learned to talk to each other, invented a complete language, and can communicate about anything they want to, then you're sorely going to be disappointed. As someone famous once said, these are not the droids you're looking for.
Very good.
So the write-up on the Spectrum publication at IEEE is very good. There's a link in the show notes if you'd like to have a look. But they take us through a bit of a thought experiment to sort of understand what's actually happening. If you were involved in some kind of plane crash and you were the only survivor, but through some kind of head trauma you've completely lost all language, and you meet one other survivor who this has happened to as well, you know, how would you start communicating with the person? You might stand there face to face and point to the ground and sort of name where you are and sort of say, so you'd meet this person. Neither of you are able to speak, and you'd kind of point to the ground and establish a word for where you are. That way, sort of laying out how your language is going to develop, is you're going to go around starting to point at places and come up with a common lexicon of describing the areas where you are. And that's basically what's happening with these robots at the University of Queensland. It's based on a study that was done some time ago where it was all simulated in a computer, but what they did in this later study was to do it in the real real world by driving little robots around, or at least letting them drive themselves around. These Lingo droids have 360-degree cameras, laser depth perception, and sonar for detecting obstacles. So they're able to explore autonomously around an environment and build up a map of where they are. Now, in order to communicate with the other robot they might find, they also have a microphone and a speaker. Now, they're not able to sense each other through the camera and immediately identify that is a robot I'm looking at. Rather, they use their speakers. Their speaker is tuned so that they can't... The volume is set on the speakers so that they can't be heard more than 1.5 meters away. That way, if one robot makes a sound, the other one will know that it's near to that robot. It's kind of like looking at a person face to face and recognizing that you're standing in the same place. So how they communicate with each other to do locational awareness is through dual tone multi-frequency signals, which is basically like you get on your home phone and you press the buttons and you hear the noises. It's a lot like R2-D2 meeting another R2 drone and going... So what's actually happening in the study is they program these bots to recognize where they are based on previous work done in computational intelligence called RATSLAM, which is simultaneous localization and mapping that is a model based on rodent studies that have been done previously. So it's basically made up of simulated pose cells, which filter the incoming data from all of their sensors, their cameras and laser detection systems and obstacle sensors. They encode the visual data into physical data that can be stored in an experience map. Now, basically, all that is just a large dump of data of where they've been. However, they can correlate all this data to say this location is near to that location, or this location has something in common with the other location. It's basically building up a neural net of the environment that they're in. So what then happens is the second part of the work for these robots is to play games so that they can agree that their map that they've built up is describing the same thing. So the scientists came up with 5 games that they would play. One was designed specifically for setting up the lexicon, and the rest were for agreeing that they're talking about the same thing and proving that the lexicon was complete. So the first game is the Where Are We game, which all that would happen is the researchers would signal to both devices through Wi-Fi that they need to start engaging in this game where they move around and ask each other where they are now. Now, based on their experience map, they would say, I already have a name for this place, in which case they would repeat that, or they would completely make up a new word. And the words were basically just taking consonant, vowel, and making 4-letter words, or very simple little sounds that the other one could identify. So the words would end up being something like Pize or Roku or anything of that nature. What they would do then is they would let these robots roam around and play the go-to game. And the go-to game, one robot would ask the other robot to go to a particular location. They would both then consult their experience map to find a path from where they are to where they need to be. They would go to that destination, and when they get there, they would start emitting their dual-tone multi-frequency sounds to see if they can see the other robot. If they saw the other robot, then they'd confirm that they'd arrived at the same place, and they permanently remember that is the location we're talking about. Once they'd set all of that up, they had additional games that allowed the robots to talk about imaginary locations. And this is where it gets interesting, because one droid could ask the other one, how far is it? Where I am now to where a new location is, how far is that? And it would respond, and if they both correlate with the same response, they were both talking about the same area. There was also which direction, in which case it is, we're standing here, we need to go there. What is the angle measure of the direction we need to go in? And if they agreed, then they were both talking about the same place. The fifth game was the where is there game. And this is where it got interesting, because the robots would start to invent areas they'd never been to. Now, they were restricted to a central room initially in the study, and then they were allowed to explore additional rooms as they opened doors, but they found that if they let the droids make up new words and talk about locations based on previous which direction and previous how far information for these made-up locations, they could both agree that they're talking about the same imaginary place that is way outside the office that they could never reach. And it's quite interesting, because they have, on the published study, they've shown a kind of visual representation of how we would see the environment that they happen to have agreed on, and a lot of times the names do overlap quite a lot, which is very good work. And this is where I'm very excited about the work they do. It's not about the language. The language is kind of second prize here, and the language isn't even completely inventing a language. What they're talking about here is the droids are agreeing on imagined locations. So that's quite substantial.
Wow, that is fascinating. I'm not quite sure how did that come about? Maybe I just misunderstood what you were saying, but how is it that they came to communicate about locations they have never been to that's very far away?
Well, if you play a game, for example, Go 2, you'd have to be able to reach that location.
Right.
And that really confirms places they've already agreed on. How far could do the same set of locations? But also, how far could do a location that's a completely new word? If they both agree on how far it is to a location outside of the area,
right,
and they both agree on which direction that is, they're talking about somewhere that doesn't exist in their mobile space.
Okay, so they would randomly come up with distances and names and then try to reach agreement
as far as
through
the
process of iteration, and then if they reach agreement, then they have a name and location for a particular spot that might be outside their own little area that they're allowed to go around in.
As far as I understand, okay, that's what did happen.
So the robots are coming up with their own version of Atlantis or Lemuria.
No, I think it's like when you press backslash on like civilization games and your boat explores on its own. I think what you could have here is two little robot guys going along and exploring somewhere on their own and sending you back information about it. I think it's cool.
Awesome. But to tie up the sort of discussion on linguistics, they're not really inventing their own language. The rules for phonology have been set out for them. The phonemes in their language are prescribed. Has to be consonant, vowel to make a word. The word can't be longer, can't be shorter, can't be a conjunction of multiple words. So it's not really inventing a complete language. They're just randomly assigning sounds to their environment. But now where this is interesting is that it's interesting in the field of linguistics when we talk about pragmatics, which is how we take a verbal abstract concept, how does that relate to the physical environment? It also has implications for further study in the field of psycholinguistics, because psycholinguistics is how is it that we go from our stored information about a location. Remember that these robots are taking different camera snapshots of the environments they arrive at because they're coming from different directions, or you know, they might randomly appear, randomly have gone left instead of right to go around an obstacle in order to reach the final location. So the picture of where they are is different. However, the word they're using is the same. And that's fascinating from a psycholinguistics perspective, is how is it that these completely different concepts in two different minds are agreed by the same common term? The study did find that there were limitations. Unfortunately, with the robots getting in each other's way from time to time, they did have some false results. So when both of them were trying to go to one location and they just happened to get stuck, they would start beeping at the wrong time and they were mapping the wrong areas and they would basically start messing with the information they already had. So there's perhaps a better way of recognizing that they're an obstacle to each other and then backing up or doing something else so that they can get a better map of their environment. Because what happened is, in the first iteration of the study in a small room, they did very well. But as they increased the number of rooms they could explore to, they had a lot of junction points where they couldn't get through the same door or something like that, and it caused the results to decrease.
That's adorable. I can just imagine them stuck to each other, like whistling at each other, like RTD2, like, get out of my way, damn it. Well, it's interesting. This might have some applications for example, space exploration. If you have a swarm of bots on Mars exploring Martian caves, for example, it could have implications for that kind of thing if the robots need to be able to map an area jointly. So it's kind of basic robotics research that's quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It would be very necessary if you have more than one household robot, for example, and while you've sent one to go and vacuum the carpets and the other one to go make you a sandwich, they need to be able to communicate with each other if they meet each other in the hallway.
Very important consideration. All right, let's talk to Michael about one of his favorite bugbears, the man called Satoshi Kanazawa. Michael?
So, saying Satoshi Kanazawa has been saying dumb and crazy things is basically superfluous. But for those of you who read my blog, I've had a sort of a feud, at least a one-sided feud, with Satoshi Kanazawa for a couple of years. In 2008, I wrote a long piece called Crazy Kanazawa, in which I accused him of being
crazy because he wrote a post claiming that the appropriate response to the 9/11 attacks would have been to nuke the entire Middle East.
That's a bit of an overreaction.
Yeah, I mean, this was his sincere belief. Now, I mean, forget that most Muslims don't live in the Middle East, but, I mean, he seems to not know or care. In 2010, Kanasava wrote a deeply idiotic piece saying that Barack Obama is genetically a Muslim because he comes from a long line of Muslims, when, in fact, Barack Obama's grandparents converted to Islam, right? So, I mean, he has a history of just saying deeply misinformed things and then not retracting it. And he blogs for Psychology Today, which is a psychology magazine that has a rather bad reputation. It's fairly low quality. And he himself, he is a evolutionary psychologist. He's Japanese by nationality, I believe, but he's based at the London School of Economics in England. And in his latest post, which Psychology Today actually deleted, they removed it from their site. You know, the one calling for all Muslims to be slaughtered, you can still find. But the current one, he claims essentially, it's hard not to straw man this claim, but this is what he seems to think. He seems to think that black women are ugly because they have so much testosterone. Right?
What?
Okay, so some background. There's been a study, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, called AdHealth, which has studied or followed a very large nationally representative sample of around 20,000 people who were in grades 7 to 12 in 1994 and 1995. So they took these individuals and they interviewed them in their homes about all sorts of topics, health, relationship issues, family issues, and so on. So it's a very in-depth interview. And then this interview gets conducted again a couple of years later. That's why it's called the longitudinal study. They follow a certain cohort for a lengthy period of time. So by now there have been, I think, four waves. The last was in 2008, where these very same individuals are interviewed again. So they're much older now, and then you can do various things with this data, like try to figure out what predicts job success. If you're in the 12th grade, what factors in an adolescent's life predict how well they'll do as an adult? That's one thing you can do with this kind of data, and lots of studies have been done with this data, which are, I believe, freely available online. Now, one interesting aspect of the study is that the interviewers rated the subjects on attractiveness when they conducted the interview on a 5-point scale. So if I'm an interviewer, I show up at this person's house and then just make a little notation, you know, this person is a 4. Now, what Kanasawa did is he took this data and then aggregated it by sex and by race. So you could take white women, black women, Asian American women, and so on, and Native American women, and then you can look at how these people are rated in attractiveness by the interviewers for each wave of the study as they were conducted, right? And his major finding is that black women are rated statistically significantly less attractive than women of other races. Now, he concludes from this that black women are objectively less attractive than women from other races. Now, the same thing, by the way, does not go for black men. So whereas black women tend to be rated as less attractive than women from other races, black men are not. And his explanation, he even says that you can still find the article, it's been removed from Psychology Today and Kanasawa's blog, but someone kept an archived copy of the thing. And he says the only thing that comes to his mind of possibly explain this result is that black women have more testosterone, and women who have more testosterone are less good looking than other women. Now,
just so deeply wrong, so deeply wrong.
Well, we can leave out that this is deeply racist for now. Let's just leave that as it may. I mean, Kanasawa has all sorts of stuff about IQ and race, and he is pretty much a quote-unquote scientific racist. But it is just abundantly and epically clear that the data he has is not sufficient to draw the conclusion he has. So just having, at most, 4 people rate the attractiveness of individuals, because these same participants are interviewed interviewed four times, presumably by four different interviewers, and you can then, and in fact, in Konasava's case, there are only three, I believe. There are three ways, he has access to three ways of data. So you have three raters who conclude over all these women who are participants in the study that the women are less attractive from women than other races, and then he says, well, this is objective confirmation that black women are ugly. Well, how about the fact that what people find attractive in particular faces depends on what they're exposed to and various forms of socialization and various biases? It's well established sociologically that black American women are less socioeconomically advanced than white American women, for example. Now, could it be that there's a kind of a halo effect where people are biased to rate, you know, these interviewers are going to people's homes. Maybe the homes that are attractive in the nice neighborhoods and so on puts the person at ease and in a better mood, and therefore in more likely to rate this person as attractive compared to someone who lives in an inner city neighborhood that's very poor, for example. And of course, this is not to say that all black women live in poverty. This is just to say that there's a statistical difference in the socioeconomic status of these women, with the black women being more disadvantaged, and therefore this could possibly account for the difference in the rated attractiveness. We're not talking about a big difference here. The difference is statistically significant, but the magnitude is not very large. Other possibilities are that what people find attractive, as I mentioned before, could be determined from faces they see regularly in the population. So I can be socialized to find a particular type of face attractive because that's the type of face I see most often. Now, this is just I've not seen any research on this, but as far as I know, the American media is saturated by pictures of mostly white women, and it's entirely possible that these raters were revealing more about their own process of socialization than about the objective attractiveness of the women in question. But this is just a classic case of someone reaching for explanations for phenomena before it's been established or well established that this phenomena actually exists. Like me going on about what could possibly, you know, be the drivetrain of a UFO before I establish that UFOs are actually alien spacecraft. Right.
But it would obviously be a warp drive, right?
Sure, but it's a giant waste of time. I remember History Channel documentary talking about how UFOs, what technologies they'd be using, these alien spacecraft. Well, you know, step one, establish that UFOs are actually alien spacecraft, and then carry on with what technologies they would have used to get here. You know, that just do step one first. And what Kanasava's done is he's taken a very small set of raters, labeled this as somehow objective, and concluded that there's this important phenomenon, namely that black women are ugly, and now we must find some sort of evolutionary explanation for it. And he jumps to testosterone. So this is just, you know, the racist implications of this is bad enough. But on top of all of this, it's just typical. It just reeks of Konasava's lack of critical thinking and his ability to think scientific.
Hang on, there's a second premise here, and that is that black women have more testosterone than other women. Is that true? Is that known?
Yeah. I don't know. He cites some research which I did not follow, but knowing Konasava, there's literally nothing he writes that I trust. so even that might be wrong. You know, we're talking about the guy who thinks Barack Obama comes from a long line of Muslims when he doesn't. Mm. You know, and 10 minutes on Wikipedia will tell you that. So this is just like a double face bomb from Riker and Picard at the same time, taken to the nth degree, you know, and added a head desk in there just for addition. But really, Konasava luckily has come in for a lot of flack, and my old articles have got a lot of traffic, so hopefully people understand that this guy is a flake. And one other aspect of this is that, I mean, in the last couple of years, evolution psychology has come in for a lot of criticism, a lot of which has been fair in my opinion, but some of which has not been. And unfortunately, evolutionary psychologists have not done a fantastic job of policing their own discipline. And what I did when I heard of this is I contacted Steven Pinker and Robert Kurzban, both of whom are fairly prominent evolutionary psychologists. And Robert Kurzban wrote back saying that he's going to write a blog post about this. And he did, criticizing Konasava about, you know, the silliness that he engaged in. And Steven Pinker wrote back that he has just co-signed a letter that's going to appear in one or another psychological journal protesting testing other claims Konosawa has made. So luckily, it now seems that the discipline of evolutionary psychology is starting to realize this, that this guy really is a liability, and that it's probably time to start, you know, explaining to people why all evolutionary psychologists are not this insane. And honestly, I think this is bad enough. I think it's reached a point where psychology today should fire him. He just is not good enough to have a blog at all. I think if he tries to make blog on Blogspot, I'm going to freaking email Google and tell him to delete this blog because it's that idiot. Not that they would, but yeah, this guy really needs to be shot down properly.
Well, I think, Michael, you're leading the charge in that respect. I think you're doing a good job of bringing him to people's attention. I'd never heard of Kanazawa. I mean, I'd seen the headlines that his nonsense had pushed out whenever he released something new, but I hadn't associated that this was the same person who was producing this crap until you wrote about it on your blog.
Well, luckily, various other, I wouldn't say I'm leading the charge. People like PZ Myers have, you know, attacked him rather savagely as well. So he's coming for a lot of criticism, and I think it's quite notable that he is the only blog, as far as I know, on Psychology Today that does not allow comment. And now that's
the volume.
Yeah, it really does. Because when he's "Let's Bomb the Middle East for 9/11 post came out, comments were still allowed. And he really got it from the commentators, really very badly. And another thing he doesn't do is he never responds to criticism. I'm yet to see him taking on critics. So he has all the hallmarks of being a crank.
I'm just wondering about the applicability of the original study, though, because, I mean, it's a study of adolescent health, and he's basically trawling through the data just looking for anything that would confirm his position that has absolutely nothing to do with health. I mean, I'd understand if he was going through the data to say, what is a person's appearance, what effect does that have in a person's access to health care? Or, you know, does race have an effect in a person's access to health care? But where he would suddenly leap completely away from the topic of health, which is what the study's about, to his racist point of view, I just don't understand where he leaves that completely behind.
Mm. The ad health is quite broad. It's called the, you know, National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, but it does include various other topics as well. So it's not just a health thing. But you're right, he seems to, you know, have trawled it for data to promote his own kind of ideology. Now, one finding I do think is interesting is that the interviewer rates the physical attractiveness of the participant, but the participant is also asked to rate themselves subjectively. And what Konosawa is, assuming he's done this data analysis correctly, one of the findings he does highlight is that both black men and black women rate themselves far more highly than people from other races. So now that is an interesting result. I don't know what the explanation for that might be, but that is interesting. It could be an interesting window into American race relations. It might be a stereotype kind of threat. It might be a reaction to the stereotype that black women are ugly. It's a sort of a self-defensive move that women convince themselves that they're attractive no matter what other people say. So that's an interesting finding, but instead of taking something that is actually suggestive and useful and could throw light on an important topic, he goes off on a tangent about how ugly black women are.
Speaking of studies into health, there was a recent article on Scientific American questioning if there's a link between the increased rate of measles in sub-Saharan Africa and HIV cases. Now, what they've done in this article is they've compared two previous studies that have been conducted on the continent. So this article is about infants with HIV and how having HIV affects their chance of dying from a secondary disease like measles. In 2008, a study was done in Malawi which found that there's only a 64% chance of increased immunity after a second inoculation amongst this population, amongst people who have HIV. A 2009 study in Kenya found that only 33% of the HIV-infected children still had measles antibodies after 5 years. Now, according to the standard inoculation schedule that's recommended by the World Health Organization, they should have strong antibodies until the age of 10 years, at which point they could have a booster inoculation. But if they're losing their inoculation much earlier, their antibodies are much weaker after 5 years, their likelihood of picking up a disease like measles is far, far higher than if they didn't have HIV. They also looked into the role of antiretrovirals, and they found that simultaneously providing antiretrovirals to a child who has been inoculated against measles has increased the longevity of the antibody. Mm. So the basic story here is that in order to prevent measles spreading in sub-Saharan Africa, the best course of action is perhaps to look at the World Health Organization's recommended schedule and adjust it for those who are HIV infected, and of course promote the rollout of antiretrovirals.
This fits in quite nicely with the study Angela discussed last week that found giving people antiretrovirals earlier than is currently recommended actually increases their health and so on. So this would suggest that for young children, even if they do not yet have full-blown AIDS, it might be a good idea just to prevent secondary infections to put them on antiretrovirals.
Absolutely. So the article author, Anna Nielsen, who published this in PLOS Pathogens, recommends more frequent and targeted vaccinations for HIV-infected children. Now, it will be interesting to find out what the World Health Organization does about this, because they've already set their measles plan in place, their strategy for the years 2011 through to 2015, at the previous meeting last year in May. So I don't know if they'll amend that anytime before 2015, or if it'll be the case that we have to wait until then that they start recommending this kind of
thing. Fortunately, the UN moves very slowly, as we can tell by the continued existence of smallpox.
This is Dr. Stephen Novella from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but right now you're listening to Consilience.
Right, moving on to some listener feedback. Angela has received a couple of comments and questions on her blog Skeptic Detective that we thought could be interesting to talk about. Angela?
Okay. So a couple of days ago, I got a rather extensive comment by someone who just signed off as Paolo. And I thought we could maybe discuss some of the questions that he raises. They're quite simple things, but quite important as well, the things that he actually addresses. And I thought we could benefit from it. So today we're going to look at two of the questions that Paolo asks, and hopefully we can help him to understand these things a little bit better. So the first thing we're going to look at is the placebo effect. And Paolo asks, how does science justify the placebo effect? How does a sugar pill substitute a drug producing the cure? Paolo says that science can't yet understand the placebo effect, but because it is an undeniable effect, widely confirmed, he is willing to bet that skeptics will accept it with no questions asked. He further says that the placebo effect sounds like pseudoscience because a sugar pill can just cure anything because you have a lot of faith in it. And I thought we could discuss that a little bit. So, first of all,
let's start by defining what the placebo effect is, right? So a placebo effect is when you take a placebo, which is essentially a sugar pill. It's a medical intervention that has no recognized therapeutic effects. And then after taking that, the patient feels better, right? They experience a reduction in symptoms for whatever reason. That's the placebo effect. Now, the reasons for why the placebo effect might exist varies from condition to condition. It depends on what the precise nature of the illness is that you're administering the placebo for. So, for example, there's the old adage: if you take nothing for your cold, it'll get better in 7 days. But if you take a placebo, it'll get better in a week. Right. So the placebo effect has had no effect other than to make you feel a little bit better about things.
And that really is the crux of it. The placebo effect produces a feeling that the symptoms have eased, but it doesn't actually have any effect on the physical condition which is causing the symptoms. And that is where Paolo seems to have misunderstood it, because he seems to think that these things cure whatever might be causing the problem.
So there's no placebo effect for cancer. There is a placebo effect for the symptoms of cancer. So if you're feeling ill and tired all the time because you're undergoing treatment for cancer, taking a placebo pill might ease your pain and might alleviate your suffering to some extent. But what there isn't is there's no placebo effect that you take a sugar pill and this gets rid of the cancer cells in your body. That's a misconception. It's not a mind over matter kind of thing that believing in something fervently will cure you of. In the first place, there is some evidence that people don't even have to believe in a placebo for it to work, right? And you can actually tell someone they're taking a placebo and it still works, right? So the placebo effect works for subjective feelings such as the experience pain, your experience of the symptoms, and so on. What it does not do is alter the course of a disease like Ebola or cancer, or if you have a broken bone, taking a sugar pill will not let the bone heal any faster. There's no placebo effect to that extent. Now, that's not to say that the placebo effect isn't interesting. Ben Goldacre has said that the existence of the placebo effect is an outrage to some extent, because there are all sorts of interesting research questions. Giving someone two placebos is more effective than giving them one placebo, for example, or giving them a placebo of a certain color is more effective, or giving them a more expensive placebo is also more effective. So there are all sorts of interesting questions around the placebo effect, and we will list some good resources to look into the placebo effect if you'd like. In fact, Goldacre has a two-part documentary series, a radio documentary series that we will link to as well. But skeptics are not at all worried about the existence of the placebo effect. It doesn't undermine any of the points we make. In fact, it strengthens them significantly. And it seems to me that Paolo is perhaps misunderstanding what the placebo effect actually is. And that's why he thinks it's some kind of challenge to science and to skepticism.
Another interesting perspective came from Simon Singh in the book Trick or Treatment, where he basically puts out, yes, there is a placebo effect. And yes, the person subjectively makes themselves feel better about a condition. But would you rather have a pill that is inert, it does nothing, and you only have the placebo effect? Or would you rather have a pill that has a proven effect, and it comes with a placebo effect built in too?
Nice.
That's a complete win, because you get the physical relief plus this placebo effect on top of it.
I think that sort of speaks to the ethics of when a doctor is prescribing something to you. If a doctor knows that you have a certain set of symptoms caused by an underlying condition, he cannot prescribe a placebo to you that will only help your symptoms. He has to treat the condition. Whereas if you walk into your natural health shop and you tell the person sitting behind the counter that you would like some homeopathy, please, he's not going to be bound by those same ethical concerns, and he will therefore not have any compunctions against giving you the homeopathy pills, because he doesn't know that all you're getting with that is the placebo, and that you're not getting that built-in effectiveness that you actually get from proper tested medicine.
Right, and when it comes to placebo medicine, in scare quotes, like homeopathy, you'll note that it's most effective against conditions that are psychogenic. So in other words, they're conditions that originate in the mind. So that's things like chronic fatigue syndrome and even depression and other psychological illnesses. Placebo is most effective in those cases as opposed to cancer or HIV.
Okay, shall we look at the second question?
Sure.
All right, this one is light years away. Paolo asks us, how does science prove that in galaxies thousands of light years away, there is a planet with Earth-like conditions, or that there is a planet with a corrosive atmosphere if no one has ever been able to touch it, see it, or even a space probe?
Hmm.
I think what he's asking us there is, if we claim that we know what the atmospheric composition of an exoplanet is, how do we know that? Unfortunately, the first thing I'd like to point out is that we don't know of any exoplanets in other galaxies. The only exoplanets we've been able to discover have been within our own Milky Way.
And not just that, but in our neighborhood, very close by to Earth, with only within a few thousand light.
Correct.
We should perhaps define what a galaxy is. So the Earth is around the sole solar system, our sun. All the eight planets go around the sun, and that's a solar system. Now, a galaxy is a collection of tens of millions of solar systems.
Or in our case, it's 400 billion.
Like 400 billion stars that all circle a central supermassive black hole, and then the universe is there are separate galaxies as well. So it's a sort of a cluster of stars that are gravitationally bound to each other and circling a central point. And there are multiple galaxies. So yes, we don't know of any exoplanets in any other galaxies, as far as we know at least, but we do know of exoplanets in our own galaxy. And it's perhaps worth discussing how we know this. Angela, tell us a bit about how spectrographs work.
Okay. Well, so once an astronomer has detected a planet around another star, how does he know what that planet is made up of? Well, can measure the light that reaches Earth from that particular star before the planet moves in front of it, and you can measure it again while the planet is in front of the star. And using a scientific tool called a spectrograph, you can actually break that down, and you can see exactly which chemicals are in the light when the planet is there and when the planet is not. And from that we can say, oh, look, there's methane or oxygen or carbon dioxide in that air. We can do that with the planets in our own solar system, and we can do that with planets in other solar systems.
We can also make various other deductions based on how large the planet is, how close it is to its parent star, what the chemicals that are present in that star. We can make some fairly reliable predictions about what sorts of elements and what kinds of conditions there would be on the planets around those stars, based on what we've seen in our own solar system and what we know about the laws of physics.
I think there's also something that Paolo hasn't really thought about. I'm sure that Paolo wouldn't disagree that the sun is made of hydrogen. The sun is pretty close compared to these exoplanets that are thousands of light years away. But we haven't even been to the sun. How are we going to get to the sun to taste it, to say, ooh, that tastes like hydrogen? That's the way that we discovered that the sun was made of hydrogen was the whole history of spectroscopy. Scientists who were working for the Vatican at the time had observations of the sun, and they noticed that when they passed the light coming from the sun through a prism, it didn't have all the colors. White light should have absolutely all the colors when it goes through a prism. There were these bands of colors that were missing. They also noticed that if you burned hydrogen and you lit a flame from that burning hydrogen and you pass the light coming from that burning hydrogen through a prism, you get the same banding. So they deducted that the sun is mostly made up of burning hydrogen. Now, that's exactly the same principle that's happening here. The light is going through an atmosphere. Some of the light is being absorbed in certain wavelengths. It's being refracted and not getting to us. But eventually, we get a pattern across this spectrum that uniquely identifies what's in the atmosphere.
And an assumption that Paolo also seems to be making is that the only way to know something is with your own five senses. Seeing is believing. Seeing it with your own eyes, feeling it, touching it, tasting it. That's the only way to know something for sure. But that's not actually true, and for multiple reasons, one of which is that there are specialists who can make you see something that didn't actually happen, and these people are called magicians, people like James Randi, who are illusionists, who can convince you that the Eiffel Tower disappeared, or that, you know, he pulled a rabbit out of a hat or a coin out of your ear, and you won't ever really, unless you become an expert yourself, you probably will never find out how these things actually happen. So seeing isn't believing, because you saw something doesn't mean it happened that way. And the other thing is that our senses are attuned to what Richard Dawkins in a TED talk has called middle world, to particular velocities and particular medium-sized objects. So our senses evolved to track gazelles and avoid lions and to interact with other humans. Our senses didn't evolve to deal with stars or to see an X-ray. And yet, well, X-rays are as real as visible light, right? They're all part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And yet, we can't see X-rays with our own eyes. And so all this information is denied to us. And unless you use complicated instruments, there is so much of the natural world. In fact, the vast, vast majority of the natural world will forever remain elusive. In fact, most of the universe is composed of dark energy and dark matter, which we know very little about. Ordinary matter makes up only about 4%, I think, of the universe. So it's this commonsensical notion that the only way to know something is with your own five senses is actually not a very good or a very scientific way of thinking about things. It's only by adding to our senses, using complicated apparatus, that we come to understand the true nature of reality. And the history of science has been a progressive improvement in our ability to access information with complicated technological instruments. So the bigger telescopes we have, the better we can see. Now that we have Kepler up in space, the space telescope, we can find more exoplanets, whereas in 1980, we couldn't. Right? So it's with our technology that we can find and discover these new things, and often we validate, as James just explained, we validate these instruments in an earthbound way, and they make the reasonable, although not perfect, assumption that the laws of the universe are the same everywhere in all directions. There's hints that this might not be true, but for now I think it's a good assumption to make that hydrogen in our sun works the same as hydrogen in Alpha Centauri, which works as the same as hydrogen in any other galaxy.
Spectroscopy in particular is the best way that we have to determine what elements constitute something. Even when on Earth, in a laboratory, if we're trying to figure out what's in a thing, we'll run it through a machine called a gas chromatograph, which is a spectroscopic machine. So we're using the exact same technique to determine what's in a thing here on Earth as we would a distant star or a distant planet, just the instruments that we use look a little bit different.
different.
So those are the first two questions. I have got a few more which Paolo raised in his comment. I have posted up a short post on my blog where I deal with each of these things, but I think that we will go into them in some detail maybe in next week's podcast if we have the time.
And if you do have any other questions you'd like us to address, please email us at consilienscast@gmail.com and we'll do our best to address any of your questions.
All right, shall we move on to announcements?
Yeah, let's do it. So we have Joe Berg's June Skeptics in the Pub, which will be held on the 1st of June.
And we have the organizer of that Skeptics in the Pub in the studio with us today. James, would you like to fill us in on the details?
Sure. We're trying a new venue this month. The June month. We're going to the Keg and Spitfire in Blackheath. You can find out all information about the meeting. It's on the 1st of June at 7 p.m. It's posted on the Gauteng Skeptics website. It's also published on the South African Skeptics Forum and Facebook.
Okay, I think that's all we've got for this week. James, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, people can find me at Skeptics in the Pub. on the internet, I've got a rather obscure blog. It's rather difficult to type in the URL, so use the link in the show notes, or you can search Google for Asinonic Skepticus. Asinonic as in cheetah. Skepticus as in skeptical.
Excellent. And Angela, where can they find you?
So as usual, people can find me at my blog, The Skeptic Detective, or on Twitter at Angela Meaden.
Excellent. And Michael, where can we find you?
I am Ionian Enchantment, and I am Michael Meaden on Twitter. Owen, where can we find you?
OwenSwart.org.
Wow.
That's where you go for all of your Owen Swart needs. Well, yes, yeah. But what kinds of Owen Swart needs aren't on the internet, really?
All right.
Well, that's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-hosts and our special guest, and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. The music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
The CDC are promoting the zombie apocalypse.
Apocalypse?
Apocalypse.